Good afternoon. My name is Suki Forbes. I'm the author of The Angel in My Pocket, A Story of Love, Loss, and Life After Death. And it is my great pleasure to announce the character study memoir panel for the Boston Book Festival. This is a great festival to attend. It's my favorite of all of them. Having been a Boston girl and sitting in the audience as well as being up here last year, I think Boston's diversity and dynamic community always makes for great content and conversation that's a joy to be a part of on both sides. Today we have Jennifer Weiner, Faith Saley, and moderated by Lisa Mullins. Lisa Mullins has had a long and storied career in journalism and in public radio. She's won awards such as a Gracie, the Golden Reel, Best Radio Voice, Best Network Anchor. She's interviewed subjects from world leaders to authors and everyone in between, and to all of her subjects, she brings a very direct and hard-hitting style. It's going to be wonderful to see her interacting with these women. She's currently the host of NPR's All Things Considered. A brief word about memoir. In my humble opinion, I think that the best of memoir involves a deep dive into the characters, both the narrator and also the individual characters who are unwittingly parts of the story. And that involves a great degree of courage and integrity on the part of the writer. And the reader has a strong sense of when you're telling the truth or not. So as a writer, it requires courage and integrity to really get your story out there. There is absolutely no shortage of that, or humor, or wisdom in any of these three women. And I very much look forward to the next hour. And with that, I hand you over to Lisa.
Thank you, Suki. Very happy to be here. And there were strange faces over to my right here when I was hearing about courage and integrity, so I'd like to find out why in just a few minutes.
I think it was when she said the reader knows when you're telling the truth.
Yeah, that was when I was waiting for the lightning bolt to, like...
Yeah, that's right.
Can I just say that as a Jew, I'm a little freaked out right now? Like, this is a lot for me. Sorry. Had to get
that
out there.
You've got two Christians next to you, but one married to a Jew, so.
All right. Osmosis.
So, I'm Lisa Mullins. This is, next to me is Faith Saley, who is a commentator on pop culture and politics, contributed to CBS Sunday Morning. Many of you may, are you going to be on tomorrow?
I am not.
Oh, you get to see her tonight.
I had a Trump commentary that was bumped because he keeps making more news, and I taped it last month.
Hey, when that happens. She's also a panelist on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on National Public Radio, hosts the PBS show Science Goes to the Movies. She was host of the public radio show called Fair Game, which aired here in Boston, and her book is called Approval Junkie. And Jennifer Weiner is a keen observer as well of politics and culture, pop culture in particular. She's the author of 11 books of fiction. Her first novel was Good in Bed. Her latest book, her memoir, is called Hungry Heart, and it's the kind of memoir that Jennifer was instructed to call a collection of essays instead of a memoir. Now, this is Jennifer's first book of nonfiction. This is Faith Saley's first book, and it is nonfiction, and there are a lot of overlaps in these two. I've been reading their books and in their lives, in the things that they have to say, in what they've been through. There are some really fascinating things that meld one into the other, and I'll mention some of them. I think some of them will also come out in the conversation. I don't know if you've read each other's books, but they begin, very interestingly, both of them, with fall, and a kind of fall. And Faith, you begin with a quote about falling, and you begin with an incident of a fall, kind of a pratfall, mm-hmm. and what do you know, it is fall. Mm-hmm. So I'd like you to begin maybe first with a quote.
Oh, the first quote of my book, it is almost the word fall. It is fail. Fail again, fail better. Samuel Beckett. I've failed better lots of times.
Which
I don't mean to brag. I'm very good at failing.
Which I read to be failing, meaning...
Falling. Yes,
falling
exactly.
In some ways, yes. Because I was also thinking of what Jennifer said. And Jennifer, do you want to tell us about yours?
Well, my book starts with an actual wipeout where I am it's a beautiful spring day. I'm walking to get my daughter from school. I've just had my hair blown out. It looks like Faith's does right now. And I'm walking, and I'm feeling really great about myself, and then my toe catches in a crack in the pavement, and I just, like, go, like, right down on my face, like the kind of fall where other pedestrians, like, run around to make sure you're okay, and, like, traffic stops, and I kind of haul myself to my feet, and I'm bleeding, and I'm battered, and I'm, like, trying to staunch the blood with McDonald's napkins that I've pulled out of my purse, and, you know, my daughter says, "Are you okay?" And I tell her that, yes, I'll be fine, and I say, "I realize this was not just a trip, not just a stumble, it was a metaphor for my life, for maybe every woman's life. You fall, you get hurt, you get up again."
So on the idea of falling and failing, and I think this is where Supi's idea of courage and a certain generosity of spirit comes in, as you describe yourselves. I mean, I think you're both experts in character studies, in descriptions, and here, with both your books, it's like you're doing a character study of yourselves. And so where does that idea of failing and falling come in? Faith, do you want to go?
Thank you, first of all. I'm honored to be on stage with Jennifer and to be thought to be a person who can write character. And it was such, having never written a book before, it was so challenging to realize that I had to see myself as a character. And thank God for my editor who held my hand through that, because what I do, as you said, I often write commentaries and I sort of infuse those with stories from my own life, but they have to be very short and brief for the medium I'm on. And when I was allowed to write about myself in a book, it was like Rumspringa. I mean, it was just I couldn't stop writing because I didn't know when to edit myself. Mm-hmm. And so my editor kept reminding me, you need to be the heroine of your own story. You're a flawed heroine, of course, but you need to, as you're bringing a reader along with you in essays, I want to hear why you were advised to call your book a book of essays, because my book is a book of essays, I think, as well, on a theme of seeking approval. So it's implicitly a memoir. She kept reminding me, and my agent too, I had an editor who was a woman. My agent is a man, and he was very helpful in the editing process. I think he's very smart and had a lot to say. He kept telling me, "Be more self-deprecating. Be more self-deprecating."
How do you do that when you're supposed to be the hero?
Right. So that was the challenge. Mm-hmm. But I do want a little asterisk there. I do wonder if men are advised over and over to be self-deprecating when they're writing their memoirs.
I'm gonna guess the answer is no.
I'm gonna guess you're right.
God, it's so interesting because I think a lot, as you guys both know, about gender and about the way women's books are seen in the world as opposed to the way men's books are. And I mean, it's not a big mystery if a man writes honestly and openly about feelings, about emotion, about loss. It's like, oh, he is so brave, and would you look at that? And boy, he's
dares
really,
to be vulnerable.
He dares to open himself. And with women, it's just like overshare.
Yep.
TMI. I don't want to know about that. And I think the self-deprecation thing, that's something that's familiar to people. It's like the, you know, the ha-ha, I'm the butt of my own joke kind of thing. And I think that's a very familiar trope in society. And I wonder what, I mean, if you'd pushed back and said, you know what, like, I'll do a little of the self-deprecation, but, like, you know, gosh darn it, I'm going to be the hero of this thing too.
Yeah. But was that hard for both of you? Because there's a lot of self-deprecation in there, and I don't know if it was encouraged or it just came kind of organically. That's kind of what we're about as women, I think.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Did you
and
have
funny
to
women. I mean, self-deprecation is a tool of humor too.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Right. And I think seeking acceptance, because you don't want to come on too strong, right?
Yeah.
This is what you mentioned, the part about your husband and how he was kind of self-deprecating in his first emails
yes.
to you, which was charming.
Very attractive.
It's alluring,
yes.
Yeah. So, but when it's a book about your own lives, how hard was it for you to portray yourselves then as the heroine of your own story?
Well, with my book, every essay has a theme of my evolving relationship with approval. So it's something I set out to do, trying to win over the approbation of someone else, you know, my high school class when I attempted to become Miss Aphrodite 1989 because, yes, I went to public school in Georgia, and yes, they had a pageant. Thank you for laughing, although I'm pretty sure your people were on the chilly side of the war of northern aggression. Or a lot of the essays were about trying to win over myself, being a tough critic. And because I failed so many times, the self-deprecation was implicit. Like, I'm telling a story of a failure a lot of times, although I did become Miss Aphrodite. And as I put in the book, it was because I had lost, I decided to lose a tremendous amount of weight my senior year because I had an eating disorder. And if you take that plus a really big perm in the South plus a Barbara Streisand song, nobody stood a chance against my emaciated spastic resolve. So the self-deprecation in ridiculous instances like that came easily. Yeah. But I think for in outlining the sort of evolution of my career, which involves, even if I'm doing journalism, involves so many aspects of performing, and even when that's woven through nowadays with social media, you have an immediate and constant and ubiquitous audience who is telling you suck, or a few creepy people who love you, who have never met you, right? Yeah. And then there's a whole bunch of normal people with whom you just want to connect. I think that it wasn't challenging for me to continuously note the places where I sort of screwed up but learned something. Mm-hmm. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, and Jennifer?
I think that's, I had the same journey where it was easy. I mean, initially what this was supposed to be was a collection of pieces I'd published already. My publisher asked if I'd be interested in doing that, and it sounded really easy, so I said sure. And then I sort of thought that I would amplify that with the stories that I tell at speaking engagements and in readings, the things that people ask writers. Where do you get your ideas? How did you get your first book published? What was it like having a book made into a movie? The stories that I've told. And then I turned in a version of the manuscript and everybody seemed okay with it. And then I took it back and I thought to myself, I'm 45 years old. It seems like sort of a midpoint where, you know, there's stuff behind me and there's stuff ahead of me, and it felt like a natural place to do some assessing. And I thought, what's the book that I wish had been on the shelf? What's the book that I wish had been there for me to read, for example, when my mom came out of the closet and I was 26, or when I had all of these crazy ideas about how my perfect birth was going to proceed and none of them happened and I really suffered as a result, or when my father died from a drug overdose. Where was Judy Blume when I needed her then? And I thought I wanted to tell those stories, and they're pretty dark, and it was a pretty hard place to go, and the impulse was to make a joke about it. Speaking of Barbara Streisand, after my father died, my siblings and I, we'd all been in L.A. We all flew home. He died in the apartment of a girlfriend none of us had met, and she explained to us that he'd become a hoarder in his last declining years. We had to go through all of these storage units and just layers and layers of junk mail and photographs and canned food and clothing and porn and porn and porn. And, you know, and first there's the porn with other people, and then there's, like, the Polaroids, and we're all, hand to God. And then, you know, so it's just like, God, what is this? And Molly, my sister, starts singing, memory, like the corners of, and we all start singing, you know? And I don't know if that's self-deprecation or gallows humor or laughing right. to keep from crying or laughing to keep from dying, but, you know, humor's the place I go. Humor, I think, is the place where lots of women go because, you know, you have to laugh sometimes because if you don't, you'll start throwing things.
But it's interesting that, it is the place you and I certainly mm-hmm. go, mm-hmm. especially if it's on Twitter. Brevity is part of it. But so, for example, I sort of casually reference having an eating disorder, but the chapter that I saved I knew I had to write for the book, for a book about approval, was about my relationship with my body still. And I remember, I mean, I had 36 essays I wrote for the first draft of my bloated manuscript, and I kept pushing that one to last because I could not go to humor on that. And there are other chapters, too. I have a chapter called, I think, humorously, Overachiever, in which I do talk about miscarriages and freezing my eggs, and that's woven through with, like, you know, humor and sadness bump up against each other all the time, if you're honest. Mm-hmm. But I did push that chapter about my body to last because I did not want to go to humor with that. That is such a dark and terrible struggle that I wanted to be completely honest.
And does that contrast with your story, Jennifer? Because you say you had kind of a flirtation with bulimia at one point, but it wasn't your thing.
No, I never managed the purge part.
Yeah.
There was no bulimia. there was binging. There was no purging.
Oh, that's what it was, binging, yeah.
Alas. No, I was... I hate throwing up. I just wasn't any good at it. No, but I...
Again, another failure
laughing,
to celebrate.
We're laughing. Right. I mean, but... No, I mean, I talk about... being at Princeton, where the toilets overflowed with vomit on the weekends because there was binge drinking and because there was disordered eating.
You could tell after women left the cafeteria and went in to go to the ladies' room, and if you looked under the stalls, you could see
the
feet facing
the wrong way.
The wrong direction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or maybe they just like to pee standing up. I don't know.
That wide stance, that could be. But I you know, it's... the quote I always come back to is the Muriel Rukeyser quote about what would happen if one woman told the truth about her life, the world would crack open. Mm. And I believe that there is great power in honesty about our body stuff, about fertility stuff, about love and lost love and disappointment and screw-ups and things that go off the rails.
That's why I had a chapter that's in the book that I really had to champion because there were a lot of chapters that had to get cut, and it is entirely about breastfeeding. And that seems like so specific and so niche-y, but I had never in my life read anything anyone had ever written that told the truth, what I see as the truth about breastfeeding.
Because it's a war.
Right, and it shouldn't be because both sides are right. Like, you either, it's la leche, I always want to say it like it's French. It's not la leche, it's la leche.
La leche.
Thank
la
you.
Leche.
La leche league, it's the most beautiful thing that ever happened. Or, you know, like Tina Fey talks about it in her book about, what is it, breast Nazis, whatever,
yeah,
breastfeeding
the nipple Nazis.
Right, nipple Nazis. And it's either, haha, let's be funny, or it's miraculous and let's make it sacrosanct. And it's both. And I want it, and it was... And for me, and I tried to do this with every essay in my book, whatever the putative subject was, I wanted it to be more than that. So a chapter about breastfeeding, for me, breastfeeding is a metaphor for motherhood. Breastfeeding is miraculous and onerous and relentless like your children and miraculous and seems to last forever. At least in my case it did, since I let my daughter breastfeed till she was 18 months and basically could say, no more, mommy. I was like, that's a clue. Okay. But at least I didn't breastfeed her till her bat mitzvah, like some people do in Brooklyn. But you know, it is universal with other women, and it's isolating. It's all those things. And so I fought for that chapter because my editor was like, "Look, there's a lot of stuff about motherhood in here. There's something you got to cut out." But I was like, "This is a truth that I haven't read anybody say."
Yeah.
Jennifer, getting to the characters that you have drawn in your other books, many other books. Do you bear in mind that idea of a woman, kind of like a, you know, a fully shaped woman, fully developed woman, as you're drawing those characters, or do you try to come up with somebody who's kind of growing? Like, are you?
They have to be flawed. They have to be on a journey. They have to be trying to get somewhere. I think
just to make it interesting.
Yeah, I mean, a fully actualized person is just going to sit around and say om all day and be happy, and there's really not many places to take her. So I think every woman I write has to be broken in some significant way and has to be on the road to wholeness, if I sound a little omy myself. Mm. But it was so interesting, having written all that fiction, and having always had the veil of plausible deniability, where if anybody was like, did that happen to you? I could be like, oh, no, 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 pshaw. You know, and I remember with Good in Bed doing radio interviews and having people ask me about writing plus-size characters and being so tempted to tell them, like, oh, the research I did, you wouldn't believe. I had to go to Weight Watchers meetings, and I had to go to Elaine Bryant. Can you believe that? And, you know, thinking that it's radio and no one would know. But with this, and I give you so much credit for your first book being nonfiction, because, like, the veil is gone, and this is me and my family, and people are just like, gosh, you know, it must have been really, it must have taken a lot of courage to tell those stories, and I'm like, no, that didn't come until after it was at the printer, and then I was like, they're going to read, they're going to know, I should have changed more, I should have made myself look better, I think that all of the characters I've written, including myself now, are, they're strivers, you know, they have good hearts, they have good intentions, they screw up a lot, they make mistakes, they get embarrassed, they have to fix things, but they're on their way to someplace better, I think, and I think that's maybe why readers identify.
Is it correct that both of you, at age 26, you, Faith, lost your mother to cancer, and you, Jennifer...
Lost my mother to lesbianism. No, it's different. No, she came out of the closet, yeah.
It's very different, but it's losing the mother that you knew.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to read that part of the
I book? Would love to read. Okay. This my mom's name is Frances, and this chapter is called Renaissance Fran. It's a joke. All right. This is how I found out that my mom had, at age 54, decided to, as her kids now say, park on the other side of the sex street. I was 26, sitting at my desk at the Philadelphia Inquirer, newspaper where I worked, writing a story and minding my business when my phone rang. It was my brother Joe, who'd come home from college to do his laundry, as one does. Searching in my mother's bathroom for toenail clippers, he'd come across a stash of love letters, and they were all signed with a woman's name. There were female belongings in the guest room, weird new foods in the fridge. There's a woman living here, Joe reported. Huh? I called Fran and said, what's going on? Oh, nothing, said my mother, cheerful as always. Joe says there's a woman living in the house. There was the briefest pause. Oh, said Fran, that's my swim coach. I consulted my calendar. Fran, I said, it's not an Olympic year. There was another pause, this one longer. Actually, said Fran, her words tumbling together, I met a woman and we're in love and she moved in. Then I was holding the phone, a dial tone buzzing in my ears, my jaw probably somewhere around my chest, stunned and numb and thinking the same thing I'd thought 11 years previously when my mother had pulled off the New Jersey Turnpike to tell me my father wasn't going to live with us anymore. I don't know anything, not anything. Should I read a little more?
I want you just, like, another minute, yeah.
Okay.
It's a great story.
Looking back...
We'll buzz you when it gets boring.
Yeah, thank you. Okay. Just throw things. God likes that. Okay. looking back, there'd been signs. Signs that had been there even when she was still married, if we'd known enough to look. The short hair, the lack of makeup and high heels, or interest in fashion, the Holly Near concerts, the vacations in Provincetown. Then again, we lived in New England. There were many suburban women in cropped hair and L.L. Bean parkas who were perfectly straight. In fact, my ex-husband and I would sometimes play a game when we'd spot one of these women, lesbian or just from Vermont. I was in my 20s, no longer living at home, technically too old to be freaked out by anything my parents did, at least according to the guidebook that, oh wait, does not actually exist for adult children whose parents come out. The idea that my mother had been lying about who she was, unable perhaps to even be honest with herself, was deeply disconcerting. What must her life have been like? And what did it mean for all of us going forward? The truth was that I was freaked out and confused and, if I'm being honest, upset. It wasn't entirely or even largely the same-sex thing, although it did put an interesting spin on the situation. No child, not even an adult one, wants to spend any length of time thinking about a parent having sex, and that's especially true if the parent is having more interesting alternative-style sex than you are. It felt like everything was suddenly backward, reversed, the street signs written in some foreign language, the maps torn in half and useless. My brothers and sister and I, we were the ones who were supposed to be out there sampling different romantic partners and trying to get our futures figured out. My mom was supposed to have answered all of her questions, or at least presumably the big ones, the one about which gender she preferred. Certainly divorced women dated, but they didn't all of a sudden just start dating women, did they? And what did it mean about our childhood if they did? Did it mean that for all the years of her marriage, through the birth of four kids, my mother had been living a lie? What was the deal with Dad, we asked, and why did you marry a man if that wasn't where your interests were? And did you even want kids in the first place? Would you have just been gay if it had been more of an option? And was the sex really awful? Like, was every thrust a stab of shame? The four of us had questions. The last two were my sisters. Unfortunately, Fran did not have answers. She was like a swoony teenager whispering and holding hands and giggling and sneaking off with her girlfriend, who was an unpleasantly gruff, vaguely triangular woman with a tiny head topped with tight blonde curls and a body that widened as it descended. Fran was behaving in the tremendously irritating way I'd probably behaved with my first crushes, doing the things I will likely find tremendously irritating when my own daughters have their first loves. It drove me up the wall when, for example, the four of us came home for that first post-revelation Thanksgiving and found my mother's new lady friend permanently affixed to her side, except for the few minutes every hour when she'd go stand out on the deck to smoke Parliament cigarettes and hate men. We'll stop there, I think. Is that good?
That was great. And there was something else in there that I think came a little bit later, but mm-hmm. You say, you know, you're wondering if your mother had the option in her generation of being mm-hmm. gay and leading a life as a lesbian. Mm-hmm. What did that say not only for her marriage, but for you as her children?
Right.
And if you were kind of meant to be.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's not a lot of fun to think about a parent who maybe didn't want to be a parent.
Right.
You know, and what my mother says is that she always wanted children and that she loved my dad. And, you know, she believes that sexuality is a spectrum and that there are some people who only like the opposite sex and some people who only like the same sex. And most of us are just floating in the middle. Fran... So, you know, she did want kids, so we're all sort of solid about that. But it was a hard time. There were questions and difficulties and this horrible girlfriend who we called her the lesbian training wheels, and my mom got rid of her, and now she's with somebody else who we like much better. Thumbs up.
So you have questions for your mother and what was going through her mind at those times and what life was like. And Faith, you have questions that you would ask your mother if she were here.
Yeah.
You have a lot of them.
I was just thinking about that when you were reading the questions that you could ask your mother even if you didn't get satisfactory answers.
Yes.
When it comes to character, it was... My mom died when I was 26. It's been 19 years. It'll be 19 years in 15 days. And I had to write about my mother. I jokingly say she was my gateway drug to being an approval junkie because I was just raised on a steady diet of validation from my mother.
You mean, but not because she was judging you so much.
No.
She used to send you notes all the time.
Just effusive, yeah. Just so loving. I remember when my college boyfriend broke up with me and I was sobbing in her arms at home at Christmas and she said, honey, I'm sorry to say this while you're in the middle of crying, but you are gorgeous even when you're crying. I mean... That is the kind of mother I had.
And this is the kind of mother she had where after she had sex for the first time in college, she called her mother to tell her.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I had to confess. And there was a pause, and my mom... By the way, before I had sex, I was 20, before I had sex for the first time in college, my mother, that Valentine's Day, before I had sex, had sent me my first thong. Like, it was my Valentine's Day present. It was like a red thong. Like, this was, yeah.
What's taking it so long,
yeah,
honey?
Yeah. So this is my mother, who's going to be a nun. And when I did tell her I had sex, she paused and she said, do you love him enough to marry him? And I said, yes. And then we both breathed and moved on. But it was such a challenge. How do you share, how do you create a character of your mother? My mother meant everything to me. And in some ways, as I am now a mother to a two-year-old and a four-year-old, continues to. I'm continuing to learn about her in absentia just by being a mother. Like, oh my God, she must have loved me this much. And you, I'm sure, already know this because you've written 500 best-selling novels, but the way in, I kept thinking, what's the way in? Because I could write a book about my mother, but it's the little details that say it all. So like the fact that my mother would do her sit-ups while praying the rosary, or the fact that when I was a kid, so I decided, how am I going to do a chapter about my mother? Like, how can I frame it without making it a compendium? And it's a chapter called Extra Vanilla, and it's about how my mom would bake. And my mom was a great cook, and she would bake. And when she died, I was the only girl. I got her jewelry and all her Ann Taylor clothes that I size 2 that I gave away to charity for all the like homeless Asian women, I guess. And I got her recipes. Mm-hmm. And I was a feminist, and I studied Virginia Woolf in college, and I didn't go into the kitchen. And then, like, I tiptoed into the kitchen after she died, and her recipes were in her handwriting, and she would grade them. And one of the questions I had for her, I was looking at her recipes, I'm like, why do you keep a recipe that's a B minus, you know? But she would always write in her handwriting, add extra vanilla. And so I became close to her by starting to bake. But here's a detail. Like, when we'd be driving down the road in Atlanta, Georgia, she'd be driving us to school, and there was this, back in the day, because it makes me sound like I'm 85 years old, but there was a chain gang that used to work alongside the road, and when she saw that, she would drop us off at school, then zip back home, and she'd bake pumpkin bread. And she'd bake them in little loaves, and she'd bring it to the head of the chain gang, and these prisoners, being very enjoying her work, but not being overly discriminating in their taste buds, called her the gingerbread lady. And like, that's my mom, you know? Or the time I called her while she was making dinner, and I said, what are you doing? She said, I'm making dinner. And I just put in some Benoit balls. And I was like, excuse me, what? And she explained to me what they are, and you can look that up at home. Or not until you're 18, if you're not. But anyway, like, that's how
she didn't mean put them in the oven.
Yeah, right. That's she did not put them too. In the oven unless
you... I just put in the roast and the Benoit balls. No.
Yeah.
No.
So
definitely that... just give a hint to those who don't know.
Oh, yeah.
I know we're in church.
If, yeah, sure. You can put Benoit balls in the oven if that's what you call your vagina. That's a hint, right? So that was the way in, and to talking about her, and at the end of it, I do feel her, and I have so many questions for her that will never be answered, and I write about how I interview people for a living. Like, I pride myself and love asking people questions, and I can't get answers out of my dad. And he's the only, like, conduit to any more knowledge about my mother, and he either doesn't know or it's too hard for him to tell me about her. And it's so frustrating. And I write at the end of that chapter, Extra Vanilla, about how when I'm baking, I feel like I exude some of my mom's energy. And I'm never going to bake as well as she did, and I'm never going to be as good of a person as she was or as good of a mother. But as my dad said in the eulogy, he said, we can't all be as good as Gail, but we can all be good like her. And so that was the frame for that chapter.
So as you, and I want to take questions in a few minutes, so if you have any or don't, please think of some now. Would you like to read a part? It's as part of the kind of seeking approval, and your mother gave you lots of approval, as you said, but you find yourself seeking approval from all aspects of your life, including your profession. So you are asked to go on Fox News and Bill O'Reilly's show, and you don't have a lot of affection for Bill O'Reilly, but as you say, he's better than the others. and you decide that you want to please him as a guest.
Yeah. So what I do when I get nervous, or just because I'm a geek, is I always prepare. So this was 2008, but going on Bill O'Reilly at the time was huge for my career. I mean, I think it's still the number one news show on television. And so I immediately, I think I was booked a week later, and I read and took notes on his memoir, which was called his essay collection, his very self-deprecating essay collection called Bold Fresh Piece of Humanity. And I did a TiVo pass on his show, and so I could catch all his quirks, and I noticed that when he liked a woman who was on a show, he called her by her last name, you know, kind of a dude thing whiner, you know what I mean? And so I wanted to go on his show, and I wanted to be, like, I knew they cast, right? They were casting, you know, feisty, funny liberal gal who needs to look, you know, porn star attractive for Fox News. I could never achieve that. By the way, have you been on Fox News ever?
Hell no.
Okay. They put you in the legs chair. That's what it's called. You are strongly advised to wear a skirt because you will be in the legs chair. And if you notice, they have like Lucite furniture. Anyway. So I did. But you know what? I wanted to make him laugh. And I knew I was being asked to do that. And I was so stupid that I thought that we would have this like Benedict and Beatrice thing going on, and maybe even his audience, you know, which is like a bunch of white people who like guns and think there should be a draft for the war on the war on Christmas. I was like, they're gonna like me. They're gonna see that, you know, I'm
you're holding your own.
Right, I'm like a public school gal from the South, and it didn't work out that way. The first time I was on with Bill, I did get him to smile, and he, you know, aborted all my jokes with a lot of interruptions, but they did ask me back. And the second time I came back, things really tanked. And so I sort of combined the responses I got from my fans at Fox News with something that happened when I was on CBS Sunday Morning. I once did a commentary for Sunday Morning, the world's most folksy TV show, called I Am Not a Pet Person. My basic point was that, please don't leave, don't hate me, hold on. My basic point, this is from a chapter called My Husband's Dog is Not My Kid's Brother. My basic point was that although, yes, I loved our French poodle Jacques Lestrap as a child, I don't want a pet now. So please don't judge me as Cruella de Vil, and I'll try not to judge you as crazy when you French kiss your pet or dress your baby up in people clothes or throw a bar mitzvah. Sunday Morning airs on Sunday mornings. The amount of rabid comments I received on the Christian Sabbath stunned me. Granted, they were not of the same creative pornographic ilk as the hate I've gotten from Fox News viewers. When it comes to which audience spews more vitriol, it's a question of quality versus quantity. First, let's take quality. Here's some constructive criticism my Fox appearances have earned. These are all real. You really don't have much of a senses of humor for a fat ass's skank. That was from Robert S. Oh, this is from J in, like capital N, Vanessa, which I think that's like a hip-hop duo, like Jay and Vanessa, like they watch Fox News together. They say, and you're a complete tool because, with 5 question marks. Here we go. This is from Steve B. You have a stupid airline slut appearance, you cow-like creature. Very disgusting, smelly-like, you slutty bitch. Fondest regards, Steve. Okay. I don't know if you have kids, but I'm sure if you do, when they were born, they must have smelled like fish. You probably aborted your pregnancies. At this point in my life, I was freezing my eggs, you asshole. Have a great life, funny girl. By the way, getting a late start attempting to be in showbiz, aren't you? I was ancient. I was 36 when he wrote that. And here's the last. You should stick to failed comedy attempts, a.k.a. grade school sarcasm, and leave the thinking to men. Play to your strengths. Then people won't keep mistaking you for a fire hydrant, and you'll stay much drier. That was signed Manhood 101. So, now for quantity. My I Am Not a Pet Person commentary delivered hundreds of responses. This is like nice old folks who watch CBS came out in droves to tell me how terrible I was. Most of them said that it's clear I've never been unconditionally loved. One said I needed to get some sun. True. And then there was Pam. This is from Pam. I would like to give Faith a cigarette to calm her down after her I Don't Want Pets segment on CBS Sunday Morning. In fact, I'd be happy to give her a case of cigarettes, _S. My boyfriend would be perfect for you. He doesn't like pets, nor does he like women who own dogs. You're both skinny and uptight, find disgust in everything you do not produce. Others see your disgust and are just too kind, a trait learned from dogs. to tell you about your scrawny, disgusting persona you cherish and force on others. I think there are rescue agencies for people like Faith and my boyfriend. It's called the Russian Space Program. Join it. The planet will be better off without you. Sincerely, Pam. So I emailed Pam back, and I said, thank you for thinking I'm skinny, and I'm actually marrying a guy with two dogs. And she wrote me back and said, okay, maybe you're not so bad, but I hate my boyfriend.
Can I just point out that the Fox people called you fat, and the CBS people called
you...
You can't win.
You can't win.
Like, there is no winning.
So I completely overreacted. And
I don't know if that's overreacting or not, but it was courageous to actually engage that at least one of the people who wrote to you.
Courageous? I thought it was kind of, it's probably dumb to engage at all.
Both
but
ways.
I decided to try to be like, I did want her to know I am marrying a guy with two dogs. I'm not a terrible person.
My guess is as soon as you respond, not that I would advise it, they see that you're a real person and they become a real person.
That often happens. I don't know if you find this. Sometimes when people tweet really nasty things at me, just on occasion I've starred it. And then they write back and they're like, oh my gosh, you're there and you have a sense of humor?
You're permeable.
Yeah.
Jennifer, I happened to notice, speaking of social media, last night at 8 o'clock I checked, and Faith, you had, on Twitter, you had tweeted 1,654 times. That's in aggregate, not just last night, but in aggregate. And Jennifer, you seem to take to Twitter more, 29,412 tweets.
I don't get out much.
And they're hilarious.
No. They're hilarious.
I mean, The Bachelor's probably good for half of them.
Yes.
Tweet The Bachelor because, like I said, I don't get out much, but yeah.
So that's very interesting. Two questions about that. One is, does it make you feel more vulnerable to be out there on social media?
Yes. Yes. Because I don't think people see that you're real. I wrote on Facebook about being disappointed that O Magazine did not review this book.
I was too.
Yes.
Well, so now I'm in good company.
Well, okay, but O Magazine has previously reviewed my books, and they even had me write pieces for them, but now they have a new editor, and my poor publicist was trying so hard, and she was writing to them every day, and finally, the editor of the book section wrote back and said, we are skewing very literary now. Which just about killed me, because I'm like, but it's, I tried so hard, you know. And then I'm like over on Oprah's page. I don't know why I'm on Oprah's page, and she's like, you know, for my new book pick, I have a frank, funny, candid memoir of motherhood and marriage. And for like a quarter of an eighth of a second, I'm like, and she's like, Love Warrior by Glennis Melton, and I'm like. So I write on Facebook, I'm just like, oh, you know, it's always the skinny blondes. You know, it's like, I write this memoir, and it's funny and candid, and she writes a memoir, and it's funny and candid. So a Jewish publication wrote a story that basically said, is Jennifer Weiner's self-deprecating humor bad for the Jews? And it was illustrated with a cartoon of me weeping while a skinny blonde woman stood in the spotlight holding a trophy. And the author of this piece tweeted it at me.
Was it a man or a woman?
A woman. A woman. And I did not know what to do with that. Because I'm like, well, if I write back to her, if I say, wow, thanks, you know, thanks for making me look nice, you know, I that's actually looking thin for me. Like, what is she going to do? Is she going to know she got under my skin and feel good about it? Like, or is she going to be sorry and realize that, like, I am a real person and I'm not, like, somebody who has somebody else, like, filtering through her Twitter replies? Like, I didn't know what to do, and I did feel very vulnerable, and I, like, you know, cried and cried and cried, and you know, and finally, like, my friend Tom is just like, you know, it probably wasn't even her, it's probably some, like, 19-year-old intern named Shlomo who's just been told to, like, you know, anybody who has an at in front of their name, you just throw it in there, but I was hurt, and I didn't know what to do, although I still, like, a part of me secretly wants to get a copy of the drawing and, like, use it as a Hanukkah card. Happy holidays! Right?
You know, I wonder...
Excuse me, Fran, hang on 1 second.
Sorry.
Do we have a microphone for... if we want to go to a question in just 1 minute, but while...
I think Jesus gave us good acoustics.
Okay. Oh, look.
Maybe if a few people can start lining up at the microphone and Faith while they do.
I just, you know, there's so much implicit in what we're saying about the way we look.
Yeah.
And I just, I wonder if, I mean, I find that when I'm on a radio show, that millions of people listen to on podcast, and people are just so much nicer when it's disembodied, right? I don't get a lot of hate coming at me from and maybe it's preaching to the choir, right? Because NPR listeners are probably already on the same page as my humor or political stance, right? But, or, well, you can speak to that too. But you know, when you put yourself out there, I highly doubt that a man who went on Sunday morning and did a commentary would have hateful feedback saying you're a fat ass, or you're talking about, you know, how his children must have been aborted. You know what I mean? There's the quality of the venom towards women.
I think that we've seen it in this political campaign where so much of the hatred and scorn is located in bodies.
Yeah.
Whether it's, you know, well, I didn't assault that woman. Look at her. Who'd assault that? Or, you know, making fun of a disabled reporter. Or, you know, I think there's just been, I think that's where we go. And maybe it's just straight from the playground. If you want to make somebody feel small, that's what you do, especially women.
Especially women. And it also happened among most of the men who were the Republican candidates, where body parts.
Yes,
you're right.
Was a yeah, huge issue
right.
As well, we can pick up on that, but
sorry.
Could you just give us your first name and your question?
My name is Kaylee, and my question is, so you had to sort of create a character of yourself, both of you, for each of these books. So I was wondering if there were any really great stories that you wanted to tell, but that you decided didn't fit the character that you had created for this book, and might you include it in a different book later?
That's a great question. Do you have an answer?
I think there wasn't much I didn't include because it didn't fit the character. There were certainly things I didn't include because the people I'd want to write about are not dead yet.
I mean, you don't talk about, I call my ex-husband in my book my husband, and I write about that relationship a lot because I sought his approval for a decade. Mm-hmm. But you are far more discreet than I am because you have children.
I was going to say, if you don't have kids,
right,
it gives you much more freedom. My ex read this and signed off on it because, you know, he is the father of my children.
My ex burned this and signed off on it.
You know, but I asked if I could write about my former mother-in-law, who was, we're not recording this, are we? We are recording this. I asked if I could write about my former mother-in-law, and he said no. So I would say that those were sort of the punches that I pulled. And it's an interesting thing to think about because Philip Roth is sort of the famous advocate of just, you know, you're not writing for great Aunt Etta. You are writing for posterity, and you are writing for the ages, and you can't concern yourself with what your family thinks. And I have no idea where he goes for the holidays, but like, I gotta go home. So, you know, those were the stories that got left.
I will say that writing about myself as a character and placing myself in a narrative and like this happened back then and there's what I learned from it and this happened here, it removed me from myself in a really healthy and therapeutic way. There were times when I'd finish a chapter and I felt so sad for that girl. And I'm like, oh my God, that girl was me. And I felt like if I could have just gone back 20 years to say, it will be okay. Like, you will meet your mensch in shining armor. You have lost your mother. You will become a mother. You will find your way. You will learn where home is. It gets me emotional now. I wish I could have said that. And so it was a matter of forgiving myself too. To answer your question about what got left out, I did, when people say, oh, you're so brave to write a memoir, I felt I'm just too forthcoming anyway. So I mean, brave is, I don't think I'm brave. It's very nice for people to say that. To me, the challenge was logistics. I was literally giving birth. Like in one chapter, my editor took this out, but I said, oops, in brackets, I just lost my mucus plug while I was writing it. sorry. And so I had a newborn baby. I was breastfeeding 10 times a day and a toddler who was not quite two in a two-bedroom apartment and no desk. And it was logistically the hardest thing I've ever had to do in my life. And so a whole bunch of chapters that got cut were like, one, I wrote this chapter about how I'm not going to write thank you notes for all the things that people gave me for my 2-year-old's birthday and for my newborn for about 3 years. But my editor sent it back. She was like, this sounds really nasty. Like, you sound very angry, and this does not make you a heroine. And then there was another chapter where, and this, I think this book is quite a love letter to my now husband, even though he doesn't quite see it that way. But there was a chapter I wrote called Complimentary Nut about how I love compliments, and I love to give them too. And I somehow married this man who sucks at giving compliments. And she was like, this isn't very nice either. So that is the answer to your question.
Thank you.
My name is Laura. So my question is more around, you know, as a 20-something, and you have all these things happening to you, it's such a pivotal point in your life. At what point did you turn the corner and kind of say, it is okay to be this forthcoming, to really share these things about myself? Because I think everyone has that feeling of wanting to talk to others and relate to others about it. But when did you turn the corner and kind of say, this is who I am, and I'm going to share this, and this is going to be it?
I think it's interesting that neither one of us spent our 20s with social media as a thing.
Or 30s.
Okay, so there was no, like, perfected life on Facebook. There was no...
filter.
There was no culling through 1,000 selfies to get the one that we were going to put on Instagram. I'm also very forthcoming in real life. Like, I feel like if something happened to me, it happened for a reason, and the reason is to tell my friend Susan a funny story about it. So I don't know that there was ever a decision about now it's okay, because maybe because there wasn't social media, I never came of age with a sense that it wasn't. Mm. I mean, definitely it takes time to find your voice. It takes time to find out who you are and where home is. And I think being in a good marriage for me helped a lot, being in a good relationship, feeling a little better about my parenting, because I struggled mightily with my first and didn't do it again for 4.5 years. I was so, like, thrown. And, of course, then I had the easiest baby ever. You know, the baby that is, like, making you think, like, I am the best mom. I am so good at this. I could just keep doing it. And then you realize it's not you, it's her. But I don't know. I don't think there was, like, a moment. Do you think there was a moment?
I think that for me, I always laugh. It's like, why couldn't I have had a chance to write a book when I was in my 30s and didn't have kids? Now I have no time. But I also wouldn't have had so much to say. Mm-hmm. And my book is not a book about being a mother, but what I went through to become a mother, surviving my divorce, a failed career. And this sort of goes back to your first question about failing, is I got to be 41 and I'm pregnant for the first time after miscarriages and finding my, you know, the beschert of finding my second and final husband. And I felt like I had just reached this critical mass of stories to tell, that my whole 20s and 30s had been about questions, and to paraphrase Rilke badly, I had finally lived my way into the answers. And I felt like I had experienced so many happy endings that I had perspective to be able to delve into the failures, because I was coming from a place of gratitude. And that's why there was no holds barred in saying this is how bad it was, because I felt like I was writing it from a safe place.
I agree with that. Yeah.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Caitlin, and Jennifer, I've been reading your books for years and years, and I enjoy them. And one of the reasons is because I'm Jewish, and I definitely connect with you on that. Mm-hmm. And so my question for both of you is, well, for you specifically, Jennifer, did you ever get pushback on making that such a feature in your writing? And overall, you know, where does genuineness come up, and is there a point where you push back, and at the same time it is something, it's a product you're trying to sell. So how do you negotiate yourself in a memoir or in your career otherwise?
That's a great question. I've never gotten pushback from anyone in my publishing circle about if this character wasn't Jewish, she would have broader appeal. Hmm. I do wonder sometimes if there are women who, like, are more likely to pick up a book with someone with, like, a non-Jewish last name, just thinking it's going to be more familiar. But my job as an author is to make my characters as relatable and authentic and as genuine as I can. And hopefully, if I do that, they will appeal to everyone, although they'll appeal in different ways. I think Jewish readers find so much that's familiar, where it's just, you know, there'll be a reference to a Seder or to Hanukkah or to sitting Shiva, and there won't be a lot of explanation. It's just part of the fabric of the story. For Jewish readers, those are familiar and welcoming touchstones. To the sorority in Texas I once spoke to, that makes me charmingly exotic. You know? They're like, I just loved learning so much about, you know, and it's like, well, okay, you know, I am happy. Because, you know, when I read like Jhumpa Lahiri, you know, it's like I learn. And so I am fine to be like your Jew 101. Like, that's totally okay with me. Yeah, but no, I mean, it's interesting because I know Jewish writers who do not write Jewish characters, who are very careful not to because they just think, yeah.
I mean, I found that Judaism being a part of my life now because my husband is Jewish and we have agreed to raise our children Jewish. I'll have you know, this was a negotiation. Husband, New York City, says to me, will you raise the kids Jewish? And I said, yeah, if we raise them Red Sox fans. Swear to God. Thank you. So anyway, they are Jewish and Red Sox fans, and it has enriched my life so much. And there's a chapter in my book called JSAP, which is what the courtship of my husband was called by my friend Danny O'Keefe. He happened to write the Festivus episode of Seinfeld. He found out I was dating John, and that John's name is spelled with an H, by the way, which is so not Jewish.
No.
But he's a Jew. He found out I was dating John, and so he announced that I was engaged in JSAP, the Jewish Semen Acquisition Project. And when my son was born, Danny sent an email that said, JSAP, ASAP, success. But to answer your question about the line of being genuine, I remember, again, this was my male literary agent who kept saying, more self-deprecation. And I have this chapter in my book about how I forged a relationship with my dad, who was not effusive, through books and literature. My first essay I ever wrote for high school was Dickens. And the teacher told me that I plagiarized it because she didn't think I could write that well because I was probably a little chatty Kathy in ninth grade. And she ended up having this conference with my very intimidating father, and I ended up getting it back with an A on top, and she said nothing else, and then lectured the class on plagiarism for the rest of the class. But my agent said, don't put that in, that's very braggy.
Ugh.
And I was like, but that happened, yeah. And it shaped me, and it made me see how my father was an advocate for me. And I am a writer, and maybe my paper as a 14-year-old was good. So there were stances I had to take, but don't want to be too braggy, so. Okay.
Did it make it in?
Yeah.
So we have about 1 minute left. There are a lot of aspiring writers, I think, here. I know, Jennifer, on your website, you have a lot of good information for aspiring writers.
Mm-hmm.
Any final thoughts here for those people who really want to do?
Oh, my God. Tell us all how to become a bestseller, please.
All right. Well, here's what I've been getting. I've been on tour for this book 10 minutes, but already... women will raise their hands and they'll say, well, I'm trying to write, or I'd like to, you know, I'm thinking about, I've been working on this thing. Like, women don't want to call themselves writers.
Mm.
And, you know, it's like, what are you waiting for? Like, someone, you know, do you need an MFA? Do you need to publish something? I'm like, if you're writing, you're a writer. And I was like, by the power invested in me, by the Spanx that I am wearing right now, you are here, you know, here and forever, a writer. Like, I mean, I think the beauty of the moment we are living in with social media is anyone can be a published writer. I mean, like, you can write a tweet and have it go viral. You can write a Facebook post. You can write a blog. You can, you know, there's lots and lots of ways to publish your work and get feedback, which I think is the key to it all. But I would say do not wait for permission. If you want to write, then write.
I would add to that what you have to believe that what you have to say matters. I mean, there were times when I was writing my proposal thinking, but... yeah, my mom died when I was 26, but I wasn't raped. I didn't flee Syria. I wasn't a drug addict. Like, I was a lucky upper middle class white girl who, you know, maybe starved herself when she was a senior in high school and had a bad divorce and was, you know, But I had to trust that the stories I wanted to tell, which are my very, very, very specific stories, and again, I was struck by this too, like you write about your miscarriage and I write about mine, and these are not stories we hear all the time, but they are so universal. People thank me for that all the time. Yeah. So you must trust that your specificity and your heart and your honesty are also universal. That you, if you think you have something to say, you have something to say. You just have to claim it. Like you said, you have to say, I'm a writer.
Faith Staley, Jennifer Weiner, thank you so much,
both of you.
And thank you all.